I'm Bob Hitchens, and I'm an alcoholic. I just want to say, with reference to Dr. Caldwell's comment about the people of Georgia buying this island, was it $675,000, Doctor? You really trimmed those Yankees. That's all I got to say. Well, I started my drinking at a rather tender age. I had my first drink at 14. Incidentally, I was born and raised in Western Maryland in the Allegheny Mountains up there, and I might say we had some pretty good drinkers in those parts. You could usually spot them. They had a little ridge across the bridge of their nose, and of course this was not from wearing glasses, it was from drinking out of mason jars. That was my first drink. It was a drink of White Lightning out of a mason jar. And that, also I, of course, had few opportunities at that point in time to do any serious drinking, but evidently my parents were sufficiently concerned about me so that they sent me to a military school down in Virginia 2 years later when I was 16. And I still didn't have too much opportunity to do any drinking there or much of anything else except what I was supposed to be doing. But on the few occasions when I was able to get out, I did enjoy drinking, and my boon companions there also enjoyed drinking, and we, in the 2 years I was there, I suppose I only had six or seven opportunities of really doing any drinking to speak of, and on those six or seven occasions, we all got drunk. Certainly I did. Now, my curiosity, going back to before I'd had a drink at all, I think it's normal for young people to be curious about liquor, but my curiosity, in retrospect, it seems to me, was not perhaps quite normal. I wasn't curious about what liquor tasted like, or even really what effect it would have on me. I was curious as to what it would feel like to be drunk, and I think that was a rather abnormal kind of a curiosity. And as I indicated to you, I did get drunk the first time I took a drink, and I got sick, and I passed out, and I had a blackout. So by the time I got to college, which was the first time really I was able to drink when I felt like it, and within limits, pretty much as I felt like, how I felt like, I just assumed that everybody had blackouts, because certainly from the age of 18 on, I did. Routinely. And I didn't think there was anything odd about that at all. I did a lot of drinking when I was in college. There's no point in trying to give you take you through all the taverns and bars and so on that I encountered during those years. In fact, I really think I could sum up my college years, which covered a little longer span than most people's and a few more schools, by telling you of a remark my father made to me at a time when there was considerable doubt as to whether or not I was to receive a degree from the institution that I was attending at that time. And what he said was, well, he said, Bob, if you don't graduate, it will be a disgrace to our entire family. And if you do graduate, it will be an everlasting disgrace to Johns Hopkins University. And, you know, the sad part of it is, really, he was right. I did graduate, however, and I went on to medical school. During these years, these college years, and I was doing a lot of drinking, I liked everything about liquor. I liked the whiskey particularly. I liked the smell of whiskey. I liked the taste of it. I obviously liked what it did to me. And I even liked the appearance of the bottles. I thought the labels were very colorful and attractive. I used to like to stand in front of the back bar and admire the bottles, or later on I'd sort of window shop in front of liquor stores. So that I liked everything about it, really. I remember one time I came home from school, and a friend of mine met me at the station in Cumberland, and He had gotten down there early and had fallen into conversation with a chap who, somewhat older, who had lived in the town I come from, Frostburg, and who had sort of emigrated over to Pittsburgh and was now eking out a living by he was sort of moonlighting in the sense that he spent his weekends bootlegging. He'd bring a carload of liquor over to Frostburg and Cumberland and sell it. So my friend sampled his wares and priced it, and he got a price from this chap of $48 for a case of, $48 for a case of Lincoln Inn Rye whiskey. This was 24 pints. So when I arrived, my friend asked me if I wanted to go in on this with him, this deal. It was a very good price and so on. And he assured me that he had sampled this whiskey and it was good. So I told him I'd be glad to. I didn't have enough money to pay for my share right then, but that I would go in it with him. So we bought this case of whiskey, and being even in those days somewhat on the impatient side, we decided to sample a bottle on our way home. It was only about a 10-mile drive home. And we did, and somewhat to my friend's consternation at least, it didn't appear to have that same mellowness and the full flavor that the bottle that he had sampled had. And I thought it tasted rather strange too, but so we only had a few drinks apiece, and we decided that it really was so very odd, so very peculiar tasting, that maybe we ought to see, my friend had a cousin that worked out at the Kelly Springfield tire plant who was a chemist, and he thought he could get his friend, his cousin, to have this analyzed for us, and that maybe we'd better just hide this case of whiskey, and we agreed we wouldn't drink any more of it until we found out whether we could get it analyzed, see if it was all right. And we did that. We stowed it away, and we didn't drink any of it for a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, my friend's cousin agreed that he would have a friend of his analyze this whiskey. But as our stock ran low and our money, we found it necessary to go to this secret cache and pull out a bottle and make use of it. And it didn't taste any better. It was pretty bad, but nothing happened to us. So we continued to nibble away at this case until perhaps a month later, we got the word back from my friend's cousin, and he enclosed the little slip that the had been the results of this analysis, and it listed all the components or ingredients that he had found, giving their chemical names and quantities, and most of which didn't mean too much to us, but the down at the bottom he had put a conclusion, and that did mean something to us, but I guess even that didn't mean too much. The conclusion was unfit for human consumption. I guess that didn't mean too much to us because we drank the rest of the case anyway. We only had about a third left. So, so much for the college years. I told you I went on to medical school, and I managed to last up there for almost 4 years until finally my ward rounds and clinics and lectures and so on began to interfere with my drinking to a point where I couldn't continue both, and so of course you know the choice that was made. Actually, to be honest with you, there was no choice. I drank my way out of a medical career. And I don't know, somewhere up in those years when I was in medical school, I think people talk about this line. Well, I think you and I would agree there isn't really any line, but I do think I passed some point of a point of no return maybe for me, because I believe that up until that time, had my motivation been strong enough, I think that I could have controlled. It was not because perhaps I couldn't. I saw no reason to do so. All the people that I liked to associate with and run around with drank pretty much as I did, or at least that was my rationalization. So I never really tried to control my drinking. I saw nothing wrong with getting drunk. Enough of my friends did this so that it wasn't considered really offbeat, or certainly we weren't ostracized because of this. But along about this time of which I'm speaking now, I think that I did pass through this time zone and crossed over into an area where my drinking changed from just uncontrolled to uncontrollable. And there is a difference, because after this, I just couldn't control it, even when I came to want to very badly, and even when I tried very hard to do so. Things began to get tougher after that. Again, I see no point in telling you about the cars I smashed up, or the trouble I got into, the jobs I lost, all the rest of it. I didn't do anything that most of you haven't done. I sometimes like to identify myself as an alcoholic, because it's substantially shorter for me to do so by just mentioning the things that I didn't do, and because I can do that rather quickly. I never had DTs, I never had an alcoholic convulsion, and I never tried to commit suicide. Now, other than that, you name it, and I did it, or it happened to me. And the happenings began, as they do again with all of us, to get a little tougher. I was committed to a psychiatric hospital where I remained for some 10 months. And again, in retrospect, I can say I believe that I did benefit from that experience, but only a very delayed benefit, because it wasn't until after I had come into AA and stopped drinking that the things that I was told during this period and the insights that perhaps I just caught a glimpse of them then came to have some meaning for me. I got out of that institution and I got a job. Matter of fact, got a job with a well-known company, at least it's well-known around here. Got a job with the Coca-Cola company. And this was up in Maryland. This was really just a summer job, and so before that closed up on me, I got another job, and with a pharmaceutical company, which wasn't too difficult, since I had a pretty good, at least on paper I did, pretty good medical background. And I started out, I was given a territory I was selling. I was given a territory in Washington. And I had a lot of trouble up there. My drinking continued, pretty much unabated. The only new characteristic now to my drinking pattern, I'd become a periodic, because I was really worried about my drinking. I was getting in a lot of trouble. I was doing, as I may have mentioned, occasional overnight stands in local Bastilles, and I was really worried. I was beginning to get really scared. And I tried to quit, and because of, now oddly enough, you know, so many people say they didn't know that alcoholism was a disease until they came to AA and heard that in AA. And yet I was taught in medical school in about 1932 or 3 that alcoholism was a disease. And in 1936, my family took me to see a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins, and this man told me that alcoholism was a disease. I subsequently saw another psychiatrist in New York at my family's behest, and this man too told me it was a disease. In fact, he knew, I think, about pretty much as much about this condition, this disease of alcoholism, as we know today, except for one thing. Couldn't tell me how to stop. He did tell me that I was just one of those people who could never again take a drink. Not one drink of anything containing alcohol, not wine, not beer, nothing. Never again with safety. And by this time, I'd had enough trouble and I was scared enough, I believed him. But he couldn't tell me how to stay away from it. So that I continued to have trouble. I was transferred from the job I had in Washington, and I was given a territory, much larger territory, which extended from southern Pennsylvania down to the Florida line, and I was supposed to stop at all the cities over 20,000 in the states along the coast here. And I started out on a very disastrous trip indeed, and it ended up here in Georgia. And I feel quite odd about being here speaking about this experience. I feel like perhaps the criminal returning to the scene of his crime, or it might be more apt to say the patient returning to the scene of his most acute illness. I had drunk my way down through Maryland and West Virginia and Tennessee, and I got into Georgia, and I spent a couple of weeks in Rome and up that way, and I came on down through Augustus, and I may have these in the wrong order, but Columbus and LaGrange and Americus, Albany, and I wound up down the southern end of the state in Thomasville. And I was drinking almost constantly. I had the sort of a job, incidentally, which alcoholics tend to get. It was a job that was very tough, really, to check up on me because I wasn't doing any direct selling, and the effects of my work couldn't really be judged for some months after I had passed that wave. So I wound up in Thomasville, and on this particular morning I woke up in the bullpen of the jail down there, and I don't have to tell you how I felt. It's the way you always feel when you wake up in places like that. And a sadistically inclined, well, I don't know whether you call him a turnkey or a keeper or what have you, but one of the guards there informed me that I was in there on a charge of vehicular homicide, which was not true, fortunately, as it turned out. So that just added to my, you can imagine what kind of news that made me feel. And in due course, around 10 o'clock in the morning, I was hailed before the local magistrate, and he asked me some questions. In the course of these questions, he found out that I was really supposed to have gone over to Valdosta several days previous to this, and he sort of terminated the hearing and said, "Come on back here, I want to talk to you." And I'm sure the very small room to which he took me was wouldn't qualify for the term of chambers, but I guess that was the idea. And he had me sit down, and he talked to me, and he found out something about me and who I worked for and what I was supposed to be doing. And finally he said, "Well, now look," he said, "you got enough problems without my adding to them." He said, I'm gonna let you off this time, but you get on over there to Valdosta where you're supposed to get to, and you quit all this drinking." And he said, "As a matter of fact, I don't want you here tonight. I want you to get out of Thomasville within the next couple of hours and get over there." Well, I was just so grateful to this man, and I thanked him profusely, and from the heart I really felt it. And I went over to the hotel, and I fortunately had enough money to pay my bill, and I packed my stuff and got my car, and I started out. This was in the summer, I might say. And on my drive over to Valdosta, and it was a hot day, and I kind of got a little thirsty, and I saw a nice-looking place along the road, and I thought, "Well, maybe I'll just stop here and quench my thirst. I'll just have a beer or maybe two." And so I went in that place, and I had my two beers, and that's all I had. And all the time I was in there, I was thinking about this magistrate, this judge. What a wonderful man he was. What an understanding and sympathetic and generous man. What empathy. And how fortunate I was to have encountered a man like this. Otherwise, I could have been languishing in jail. And so I had my two beers, and I went back and got my car, and I continued on towards Valdosta, but those beers in that kind of sun and that kind of heat just weren't enough to keep me from being thirsty. So I stopped again and had a few more beers, and then I'm still thinking about this judge, too, what a very kind and understanding man he was. And I got down a couple miles down the road, and I stopped again, and still thinking how lucky I was, until it suddenly occurred to me, well, you know, really, that business about be out of town before sundown, that's pretty corny. That's kind of grade B Western stuff, you know. And, so I went down the road another 5 miles, and I stopped at another place, and I began thinking about this. I guess I'd been thinking about it while I was driving the car, too. You know, what is this business, be out of town by sundown? I mean, come on now. And the more I thought about this, the more I realized that my constitutional rights were being abridged here. And I just said to myself, they can't do this, and I'm going to straighten them out. And I turned right around, and I went right back to Thomasville, and I don't have to tell you where I wound up the next morning. Right in the same cell, this time with a drunken driving charge against me, and I was convicted on that, as I should have been, of course, and I had to wire for money. Very embarrassing. I had to wire my office. My folks weren't home, and very, very unfortunate. Well, those kind of things happen, but they weren't the bad things, really, you know. They never are. It isn't the smashed cars, or it isn't these unfortunate encounters with the law, and it's not the lost jobs that really matter. These are all the externals. These are not the important things. The important things that happened to me were the things that happened inside me. The destruction of my such self-respect as I had had, the slow loss of confidence in myself, in my ability to ever solve this problem, and finally, the really complete, terrible feeling of hopelessness when I became convinced that I just wasn't going to solve it, and that I was condemned to go on drinking in this increasingly catastrophic fashion periodically, until something happened to me, something where it would put me someplace where I couldn't drink. I finally moved up to New York, and I had to give that job up. I quit that one just before they fired me, I'm sure. And I moved to New York, and I began seeing a psychiatrist again at this time, having, as I say, because of my a medical school background, I felt that if there was an answer, I would probably find it through psychiatry. But, of course, I didn't, and I didn't for the reason that very few, it seems to me, alcoholics do, because I lied to this man. That was one big reason. I didn't tell him the truth, and I just don't think that he certainly tried to help me. In fact, he's the first man that I heard from whom I heard about AA. Now, he didn't know much about it, but he was sincerely interested in me and trying to help me. And, of course, I was seeing him as an outpatient, a private patient at his office. And one day he said to me, Bob, there's some people here in New York. I guess this must have been about 1939. No, about 1940, I guess. He said, there's some people here in New York, and they have this same problem that you do. And they found a way to work out an answer to this. Now, he said, I don't know too much about them, just what they do, but I know that if you feel jittery or you're nervous or upset and you feel as though you want to take a drink or you have to take a drink or you're going to take one, all you do, you call these people up and a couple of them will come around and take you bowling and get your mind off this drink. But I didn't do anything about having him look them up for another year and a half or year and three quarters, and I'm almost ashamed to tell you why I didn't, but I didn't because I didn't like to bowl. Didn't like to bowl. I wanted none of that. So, I didn't. Meanwhile, my mother sent me the Saturday Evening Post that had Jack Alexander's article in it. Came out March 1941, and I read just enough of that article to see what it was about, and I tore the Saturday Evening Post into about six pieces and threw it in the wastebasket. I didn't want to read anything about that. And I think I can see now a curious sort of duality or ambivalence about my attitude about drinking, because I was really scared to death. I really was. And I did want to stop drinking, and I did try to. At times I did. And at other times I say, here's somebody trying to help me, and I wouldn't even bother to read that whole article. I just tore it up and threw it in the wastebasket. So that it's difficult to understand this kind of thinking. On the other hand, who can understand alcoholic thinking? I certainly can't. My own or anybody else's. So I didn't look up AA then either. Until, and it wasn't until I found myself the following year in a little bidewee out on Long Island, the sort of a place they don't have anything as crude as bars on the windows, but they do have the kind of ornamental grill work, which is just as effective in keeping you inside. And this was 7 years after this 10-month stretch I did down at Shepherd Pratt. And I looked back and looked at those 7 years, and it was a pretty dismal picture. And I just hadn't accomplished anything. My drinking had become worse, not better. It's true, I wasn't drinking all the time during these 7 years. I was a periodic, but once I did start drinking, well, in the first place, I never knew when I was going to drink. I didn't have to have any reason for drinking. And once I started, I couldn't stop until I was either physically restrained or until I became so sick or so broke or some combination of these circumstances that it was just impossible to continue. And truthfully, my drinking eventually simply got to a point where once I started, my whole world narrowed down to just one thing, and that one thing was the next drink. That was the only thing I was interested in. No responsibilities or obligations to family or anybody else, nor to myself. It made any difference to me. I didn't care whether it was night or day or what day of the week it was or where I was. Only thing I cared about was where was the next drink. Well, to come back to my looking at myself on this occasion out on Long Island, as I told you, I remembered AA. And I couldn't even remember the name of it, but I asked one of the doctors at this place about it, and he did know about it. And I asked him if he thought it would be a good idea if I got in touch with him, and he said he certainly did. So he said he'd get me the address. I didn't know it, and he got me the address. And the address was Box 459 up in New York, Grand Central Annex. And I wrote a letter to these people, and I mentioned this talking to some friends today. I wrote them a letter, and I said, I may be having some trouble with my drinking. Now, mind you, I'm locked up in a nut house when I'm writing this. I may be having some trouble with my drinking. And I understand that you're interested in helping people who do have a drinking problem, and would you suggest that I... what would you suggest I do? So I got a letter back and said, well, we would suggest that you come around right away and see us. So I wrote back again. I said, well, I'm not exactly at liberty right now, but as soon as I am able to do so, I will come around and see you. And about 2 weeks after that, I was let out. And I went back to New York, and my wife had temporarily at least moved out of the apartment. And I thought, well, I better get down there and see those people, and I did. I went down to the clubhouse on West 24th Street, and I walked in, and they told me to go upstairs, and I did. And I talked to the secretary, and right there, the first, and for me, you can call it what you will, for me, it was a miracle. Because on that, right then, right at that first moment of contact with AA, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I didn't think of it in terms of sanity. I'd never heard this sanity bit. But I came to believe that what I was looking for was right there. Because I had never talked to anybody who was able to convince me that they knew what I had experienced. And this was a a girl that I talked to, a lady. And I had no question about it. I knew that she had been through many of these same experiences that I had been. I could just tell it. I sensed it. So I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. As I say, I had never read that. I didn't think of it in those words, but that's what happened to me. And they told me to come back. They said, come back. Our meeting. We have our meeting tomorrow night. And I went back to that meeting. And this time I knew, I absolutely knew. I had a conviction that I have never lost from that night to this, that if I were willing to do what these people said, that I could lick this problem. I knew this. And I went back home. I can remember riding home on the bus that night and thinking to myself, well, this is a long way down here from where I live. Probably take me 3/4 of an hour to get here. But I believe I could manage to get here once a week. Well, with that kind of a... Now, mind you, again, here's this duality of feeling. I wanted desperately to stop drinking. I wanted what I found, what I had sensed there at that meeting. And yet, on the way home, I'm thinking to myself, well, I guess I could manage to get down here once a week. So what happened? I didn't go back. Actually, I became ill and was hospitalized, nothing to do this time with drinking. And by the time I got out of the hospital, this experience, which was had been a tremendous emotional experience for me going to AA, had kind of faded into the background. And I kept thinking, well, I better go down and look those people up. But I didn't, so I had to have one more drunk before I went back. Well, I went back. And this time, my attitude was different. I wasn't thinking about, well, I can manage to get down here once a week. This time, I was ready to do anything they said. Anything at all. If they said, spend every morning, afternoon, and night down here, I would have done it. If they'd said, leave your wife, quit your job. Of course, those particular eventualities didn't arise because my wife had left me at that point, and I didn't have a job. But I really was. I was willing to do whatever these people told me. And as a matter of fact, after my wife returned and I was faced with some of the problems that we're all faced with after we start trying to pick up the pieces, I made an agreement with her that I would appoint, they weren't going to know this, but I appointed a little committee, and my brother-in-law, who of course was not an alcoholic, and my sponsor, and one other AA, and I agreed that if my wife and I couldn't, if we differed on anything of any importance, I would put this question, whatever it was, and she agreed to it too, up to this committee, and whatever they said, that would go. And actually, I don't know that I ever did put anything up to the committee in quite that sense, but I was willing to do this, and I'm sure I would have done it. About 4 months after I came in to AA, and I must say that during these 4 months, the thing that kept me sober was the physical part of AA. It was the people and the meetings. Sure, I bought the book. I bought the big book, and I went up to Central Park one afternoon. And I read the whole thing, cover to cover, and I thought, well, that's that. I've done that. So, and I read such other literature as there was at that time. Wasn't too much, and I went to all the meetings I could. But about after I'd been AA about 3 months, I got the greetings from Uncle Sam, which were being issued back around that time. This was 1942. And then I really was scared because I knew, really, that the only way I had kept away from a drink was every time I felt upset or felt that I wanted a drink, I just made a beeline down to the clubhouse there, and there were always some people there that I could talk to, or at the very least, I could pick up the phone and call somebody and talk to them. And I didn't see how the devil I was going to stay sober in the Army. So I talked to my sponsor about this. He was a sort of a... I had appointed him my sponsor. And, well, he said, Bob, I don't think you have to worry too much. He said, you may not have noticed it in these months. You've been kind of busy. But we have a program of 12 suggested steps here in AA. And... said, I would suggest that you read those and that you devote a little thought to these things. And in particular, he said, I would suggest that you devote a little thought to the 11th step. Well, I wasn't sure what the 11th step was. I had to hustle off and look it up. But it had to do with prayer and meditation. Gee, that threw me because I had not had very much a formal religious training when I was growing up. And as a matter of fact, my concept of all this kind of thing, I considered myself a very broad-minded individual when I said that, well, I wouldn't deny that there was a God because I couldn't prove that he didn't exist. But of course, after all, you couldn't expect any one of my intellectual attainments to accept such a theory, and it was no more than that until somebody could prove this. Let's back it up with something. But I really thought this was quite a broad-minded attitude on my part. So I think I've been hearing about God in these months in AA, but really didn't have much meaning for me. Well, I went back to my sponsor and I said, look, what am I going to do? I'm really scared. I don't know anything about prayer and precious little about meditation. Well, he said, you better learn. And so I talked to him a few times and I began to think, gee, here are all these people that I admire and whose opinions I respect, and they don't seem to be have any difficulty in accepting a concept of a power greater than they are. So I began to think about this and look back at my life, and maybe this wasn't going to be so difficult. And about that time, I was drafted and went in the army, and I was, well, the only way I knew to develop do anything about this 11th step and Bud had suggested it to me. Well, you just start out and you just got to learn to pray. Well, I didn't know any prayers. I did know the Lord's Prayer, and I started with that. And I'm sure I'd say that at night silently to myself after I was in bed for many, many months before it meant a single thing to me. I didn't get a benefit that I could see out of it. Nothing. No lights lit up. No bells went off. I just felt kind of silly, frankly. But I kept on with it because I wanted to stay sober. And the people in New York were very good to me. They wrote to me, and I wrote back to them about the problems I was having, and they said, stay with it. So I did, and the time came after maybe 4 or 5 months when the Lord's Prayer did begin to mean something to me. And slowly and very, very painfully, I did begin to learn a little bit about prayer. And I did come to believe that this was the answer for me because it's the only answer I had. There wasn't any AA there, and I didn't take my book with me. I thought this would be terrible if it was discovered by my buddies and so on. But the 11th step worked for me. So I came back out of the army, and I didn't have a job. Looked around for a while, and nothing turned up, and my wife was working. This was a bad situation psychologically, of course. And then it occurred to me, well, you've been praying here for sobriety and for various other things. Maybe you could take a shot at praying for a little help on this job business, too, because I've got obligations here now, family obligations. So I tried that, and that worked, too. Or anyway, you can call it a coincidence if you want, but anyway, within 2-3 days after that, after I prayed for some help in getting a job, I had one, and I prefer to think of it as an answer rather than a coincidence. And I got active again in AA. Well, after 10 years in AA, I ran into a difficult period for me, a period of great emotional crisis. My wife and I separated, and I had some other problems, personal problems, and I became very upset, and I was very distraught, and I couldn't eat really normally, and I couldn't sleep. I had a great deal of trouble sleeping, and I tried going back to this, my friend, the psychiatrist, whom I had seen before I came into AA, and he didn't seem to be able to help me. I tried talking to my AA friends, and I tried repeating the slogans with which you're all familiar, and I tried reading AA literature. Nothing seemed to work. And I was really in bad shape because I just had a terrible time sleeping. And I would get up at night and go out and walk the streets. And this particular evening, I was doing that. I was walking out around the streets. It was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I just couldn't, I was too nervous to stay in the apartment. And as I walked down the street, suddenly, and it was a very peculiar experience, I shan't attempt to interpret it, I'll just relate to you what happened. Suddenly, I saw a room. And I knew what room it was. It was a smoke-filled room, a typical AA meeting room, and I knew exactly it was where the Chelsea Riverside group at that time, or prior to that, had had their meetings, and I was in that room, and there was a girl speaking, and she gave a quotation, and I saw, not heard, I saw those words. Now, I can't tell you how I saw it, I can't explain this, but I did, and I heard them too. And I don't know to this day who that girl was, and I don't know from whence she got this quotation. I've never been able to find it. Maybe, I don't know. But suddenly, these words appeared in front of me, and in this context of this meeting room, and I knew that I'd been to this particular meeting some years before. Nothing about that particular meeting had impressed me at the time any more than any other. I'm sure that I hadn't given it a thought from that day, which was at least several years before, to this night. Nonetheless, these words came to me. And what this girl said was, the quotation went like this, "Walk with patience the road that is before you." And somehow, when I heard and saw these words and went back in my memory to that night and experienced that night again, hearing this girl say this, that did for me what all these other things had been unable to do. And I was able to go home, go to bed, and go to sleep. And that marked the turning point of that very bad episode for me, because all I had to do was think about this quotation, and it quieted me down. And of course, it symbolized to me the acceptance and the action which is implicit in this program. The walk, of course, was the action. Didn't say sit there by the side of the road and feel sorry for yourself. It said walk. And so I had to keep moving. I had to go forward. And but not just walk, but with patience. Walk with patience. And that patience, that comes hard to a great many of us, and it does to me. But I thought of it, and it would help me. And then, of course, the final part of it, the road I had to walk was the one before me. Not the one I wished I was on, not the one over there that may have been a smoother one, or the road over there that might have been a downgrade, but this one right here that I was on. The upgrade, the one with rocks all over it, but that's the only one I had, and that's the one I had to walk. And when I was able to accept that and keep walking, my troubles started to disappear. And when I've gotten myself into difficulties since then, that has still proved very helpful to me. So, just before closing now, I think I should tell you one more thing. A great many people I've heard speak in AA have said that they obtained a complete release from the desire to drink from the time they first came in. And I think that is great for them. Maybe that is true for most people. I don't know. But that has not been true for me. Periodically, since I've been in AA, I have wanted to drink, and very badly on many occasions. This has been unpredictable, and several years at a time have gone past without my even giving a thought to taking a drink. And then, in different ways, under different guises, along comes this desire to drink. It first came on me in the form of a kind of a, well, you know, I'd start thinking, maybe I'd be going on a trip, and I'd think, well, I'm going out to Detroit or wherever it might be, and, you know, nobody'd really know if I did have a drink. And of course, I realize it's true, I'd say to myself, I realize it's true that no one that I know has ever succeeded in successfully taking a drink after, if they were an alcoholic. And I don't know anybody, but who knows, maybe I'd be the exception. And the next thought would be, maybe I owe it to humanity to make of myself a guinea pig and conduct this scientific experiment. And I'd know even I was thinking this, that it was a lot of nonsense, you know. But I couldn't stop it. I'd go on day after day. I'd continue to toy with this fantasy and this kind of thinking. And then finally I developed an answer to it. And so then my answer, I just said, for the sake of argument, let's concede that you are the one person in the history of the world who is going to, having been an alcoholic, you're going to be the one person now who can become a social drinker. Okay, we'll concede that you can do this. All right now, Mr. Social Drinker, what is it that you want to do? And I'd say, well, I want to have a martini before dinner tonight. And then, of course, I'd immediately realize, that's ridiculous. I don't want a martini. I want 20 martinis, not one. I don't want to be a social drinker. That's preposterous. So then I'd have to laugh at myself, and that would be the end of it until the next time. This thing has come on me in other forms, just a sudden, almost compulsion to take a drink. And I expect this to go on as long as I live. I just hope that I won't take it. Up to now, I haven't. And the reason I'm telling you this is I don't think that it gets mentioned too much in AA. It really just worried me to death for a long time. Even after I talked to people about it, the way some of us have dreams, this desire to drink plagued me. But I think if by any chance any of you here are troubled in this way, you shouldn't be too concerned about it. You shouldn't worry too much about it, because it really doesn't matter whether you want to take a drink or whether you think of taking a drink. The important thing is whether you take it or not. And if you don't take it, the rest of this, I think you can live with. Certainly, I have been able to. Now, I think our time is just about up here. I want to thank all of you collectively for making this a very happy and rewarding weekend for me. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to go back about noon tomorrow, and I won't have an opportunity to be at the banquet tomorrow night and to continue to meet with you after noon tomorrow, but I do want you to know what a wonderful time I've had, what a wonderful experience this has been for me, and I hope that I will be able to talk to most of you anyway between now and noon tomorrow. Thank you very much, Bob.